Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 9th, 2003. Today's session is Lifting Up by Getting Down, a session with the Friesen-Carper family. Number FRD 2003-01. Let's listen in.
Begin, Bernard Carroll. I'm Dennis Friesen-Carper. I direct the orchestra and teach classical composition at Valparaiso University. And kind of a closet church musician. I do not have a parish that I serve as church musician. I have at different times in my career. As a matter of fact, my first conducting position was a church choir while I was a sophomore in high school. So I had a long interest in church music. I sang as a boy soprano, and then after my voice changed, I didn't sing again for a long time. But I love church music. Compose a lot of church music, although most of the music that I compose in my regular life outside of Holden Village is in what we would identify as a pretty conservative, classical, contemporary classical style. I enjoy a lot of different kinds of music, however, and I have a lot of experience playing, particularly jazz. I love jazz. Made a lot of money when I was in graduate school, supporting my family playing jazz. And that has prepared me in some ways, like the music of the Bach chorales is kind of the, in some ways for harmony, study of harmony, it's kind of the core repertory of Western art music, is that that's where you learn how to analyze for passing tones and secondary function and all that kind of stuff. In many ways, jazz in American music, if you can understand jazz, you can play jazz, you end up having the ears and the rhythmic and harmonic, at least it served for me, to give me the rhythmic and harmonic tools that I needed to go to play country when I got called into the country studio when I was in graduate school in Houston. I played a lot of country records. I was able to go in, hear what I needed to do, and fit in. So since I was in high school, I have been playing church music in styles other than the style that we all grew up with, being accompanied by the organ. So what I'd like to do today is talk a little bit about church music history. Don't worry, it's be short and to the point, but talk a little bit about church music history, where we are now, and then I'm going to spend most of the time talking about what I see as kind of dominant styles in what we would call vernacular church music. For lack of a better word, music that's not the old traditional LBW, and where its roots are from. And I'm anxious to answer questions for you if I can, or engender some conversation. I do have a fair amount of material. I've chosen to use this mass with you, not only because I'm shamelessly promoting my own work. Actually, this has been a workshop setting for me and an extremely helpful one. We've done parts of it at my church, but we've never done the whole thing. So last Sunday was the first time. But also because it was composed specifically on a request from the ELCA for the creation of settings of the liturgy that could be accompanied in multiple styles. Because they see a need for that and a desire for that. And so I'm critical of my own work and may, you know, raise some of the issues that I have, certainly. To any questions you have about it. But I'm using it because it's convenient and because it was designed to be accompanied in a number of different ways. As we look at the history of church music, I'm sure that you are all aware that we started, the Western, or the Christian church started out with Jewish chants, and so that earliest music, we're confident, had a very Mediterranean kind of flavor. Jewish cantillation. We have no way of knowing how much it's changed through the centuries, but our presumption is that, at least in the Middle East, what we hear today bears a lot of resemblance to what was happening in the days of the early church. As the rite got more and more codified in both Constantinople and in Rome, the chant became somewhat smoother, we believe, and by the time we get to the 900s, the kind of thing that we're used to, the very smooth, beautiful Gregorian chant, was well established. Then a very interesting thing happened, and we first have it written down in Paris at around 1200. But this wonderful, fluid, gorgeous chant began to be accompanied by voices doing other things. One voice would hold a long note. And over the top of that would be. What does that have to do with it? A lot of times there aren't even any syllables associated with it. But dee da 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 dee dee da 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 da. Where does that come from? Well, it's dance music. People are singing dance music in church. And they're using the rhythms of dance. And at that time, the people who were writing about rhythm were using what they called rhythmic mode. So you would have a steady pattern. The one that I was singing for you, da da dee da dee da dee da da da, and a pest, da 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 dee da da. And the rhythmic modes were part of the theory of music at that time that got passed down to us. So this is around 1200. Well, for me, this is the big revolution in church music. This is where everything begins, because we've had one line up to this point. Occasionally we've had accompaniment by fifths. Very virtuosic. And so if you think about the, well, we'll do that in a minute. That's around 1200. This style of counterpoint became more and more codified. Around the time we get to 1600, it has become very dressed up and very formalized, the music of Lassus of Palestrina, the high Renaissance church music, which was a model of balance. Some of my favorite music still, the music of Vittoria, of Lassus, people who unfortunately rarely get sung in American churches anymore, although you certainly do hear them in bigger cathedrals and in some European churches. But around the time of 1600, another revolution happened, and again, it came from opera, but the same people were writing opera as were writing church music. And they began to write music for a soloist being accompanied by a keyboard player who was not just playing voice parts, but was playing an independent part. So you have a solo with accompaniment instead of a large choir of people singing in mixed parts. Okay, another 400 years, we come up to the year 2000. And as you take a look at what has happened in the late 20th century with church music, I think there are many parallels. A lot of church music, and now this would leave out churches who depend heavily on the 19th century revivalist tradition, although in some ways you could see the introduction of rhythms happening there already, sort of presaging what's coming in the late 20th century. But many churches with the organ, the music is what a lot of young people would describe as kind of funereal. It's very smooth, it's all even, the harmonies are quite predictable, they're very regular, they happen very often. As a matter of fact, that's something which a colleague of mine from Concordia Bronxville has suggested is something that's actually upsetting to congregations, how fast the chord changes are. If any of you are organists, I'll say a few things that are, or church musicians, I'll say a few things as we go that are more technical. But as we think about the kinds of changes that have happened in the end of the 20th century, part of what's happened is that we've had an introduction of a lot more rhythm, many different layers of rhythm. Where does it come from? It comes from rock and roll. It comes from popular music, essentially. Jazz has been a fairly secondary influence. It's mostly the music that people listen to on the radio. Very much like in the 12th century, the music that was being played for the weddings was being imitated in the church. We've also had a move away from the four-part kinds of choral accompaniments that organists played and choirs often sang and some congregations sang, a movement toward a much more soloistic style, again, based on popular music. as we teach young people who don't play the keyboard at the university how to get around on the keyboard. It's astonishing how the skills of playing Baroque music, where you have to read a bass line with chord symbols underneath it, how similar that is to reading a melody with chord symbols above it, which is the late 20th century means of communicating musical information in a short amount of space. So the Baroque figure bass, thorough bass, which began around 1600, is paralleled here. So I guess one of the things I want to say is that the culture wars surrounding music in the late 20th century are not new. There was a great deal of invective that flew around in the 1600 about this horrible destruction of this beautiful, perfect polyphonic style. And as much as we're sad that that's over, what came after was also wonderful. But I think in the late 20th century, our revolution of utilizing popular musics in church is probably no less of a big deal, musically speaking, than was the change that happened around 1600. I think it's a bigger change by the guitar and the piano beginning to dominate, as they do here at Holden. I hope you've never tried to play the organ in there, because it's very sad, and it's unconsciously almost insulting to the church music tradition that we've grown up with, because nobody cares about it. I used it last year. One of the speakers was blown out because the chipmunks had gnawed at it. How long ago did that happen? Who knows? Well, of course there are no pipes there. You know, who would want to try to maintain pipes up here? And I think that it's unfortunate that we can't keep both traditions alive. And there are some churches where that's being done very well, and that's certainly what I would propose and what I would suggest. But so anyway, a little bit of insight into what that change is like. As we look about how do we do it, I have to say honestly, I do not go to a church where we do contemporary music all the time or vernacular music all the time. I don't worship very well with that kind of thing. I had a bit of conscience when I was first asked back in 1969 to start playing This Little Light of Mine for church services of high school students. I had a little conscience about doing that because it just didn't feel quite like church. I felt like I was being involved in some kind of a betrayal there. And I think that I always do have a little twinge of conscience about it. I can remember in 1966, I was in a church at that time. I did not grow up Lutheran. I should have said that to begin with. But I was in a church where a fellow who was a reformed jazz band saxophonist would only play the saxophone playing exactly the notes that the congregation was singing, and only on set on Sunday night. He would lead the church singing with his saxophone. He was a magnificent player. He played only the notes of the hymns. He would not play anything else. And my Sunday school teacher in that church, was very clear about the fact that music with rock and roll rhythms was the work of the devil. These rhythms were infecting the spirits of young people. Well, I mean, it's funny and it's superstitious in a way, but you have to realize, I believe that there is a very strong sensual element to this music. It is music of the senses. It is music of the body. The African religions where this music was native are many of them fertility related. I don't think we can kind of dismiss that sort of thing out of hand, but I do think that we need to be aware that, like many other things in our lives, there's a certain amount of sublimation, if you want to be Freudian about it, that goes on when we take music with this kind of energy and we put it into the church service. And I think churches actually, I was on a call committee which interviewed and actually called, much to my consternation, a person who was a member of the Willow Creek Fellowship. He was a Lutheran pastor and now serves a large church in our state. And so I went to Willow Creek because I knew nothing about it. And I read some of the materials and talked to some people. And I think that they, where they use that contemporary kind of music with an orchestra on the stage all the time, and I think that they have an appreciation for the fact that there is a sensuality inherent in highly rhythmic music. And that's something that people need to be shepherded through, and they need to be, you know. So I think it's good for us to have some awareness of it. So let's do begin talking a bit now in somewhat more technical terms, and please reel me in and ask questions as we go, because I will, just kind of go off on some of these things musical. But I'm hoping that it will be interesting both for people who are musicians and people who aren't necessarily. I would like to talk a bit, again, as we did about the rhythmic modes, about the origin of the rhythms that we use in vernacular musics. And they do come from Africa. There is a standard bell rhythm, which I have written up here, which is still present in the music of a lot of the music from Ghana, Nigeria. I was very fortunate when I went into Chicago to buy an African drum. This has been stuff I've learned since being in Valparaiso, so learned in my 40s, actually, some of this detail. Boy, that's glaring as well. Can you read that notation up there?
Yeah. Oh, would you have the lights on top a little bit?
I think that actually is this. Can you just shut the thing up there? I think that will help.
Yeah,
I think that'll...
Thanks
very much. So many times when you hear traditional African groups that from that West African strip of West Africa where the slaves came from, taught this phrase by the guy who sold me the drum, who came from a family of African musicians, though he actually himself was a very interesting and wonderful painter. By the way, his grandfather had been Christian, but the family had with them. Kongolo, 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 kongolo. So when I asked him how to play my drum, he didn't show me the technique. He didn't say, okay, now you need to hold the stick this way and then put it, I was buying a talking drum. And you put it under your arm and then hold your leg this way. Didn't do any of that. He just picked it up and he played this rhythm. He said, that's how to play. So the first thing that you have to learn about it is, what is the rhythm? And this is the rhythm. That's kind of complicated rhythm. But if you want to get the music, this is what you have to get. Well, if you would count eighth notes in this phrase, you'd find that there are 12. And if you think about 12, it's a wonderful number because it's dividable by 2, by 3, by 4, and by 6. And in African music, all of those levels are happening at the same time. And you have some people who are doing groups of three and then groups of two. And we'll find that that juxtaposition carries right through Latin American music and through a lot of American music as well. Okay? So let's take a look at it just a little bit analytically. You see, I have done a reduction down here that relates to American music and African and Latin American music. Here we have, if we think of this as being in 3/4 time, okay, and that's the way I kind of notated it with the bar in the middle. 1 and 2 and 3 and 1 and 2 and 3 and. These are all off the beat, starting from here. These are all on the beat. So I have 3 on the beat and I have 4 off the beat. Excuse me, 3 on the beat, 4 off the beat. So it's a 7-beat pattern that goes with a total of 12 pulses underneath. This is also performed a similar way in 4/4 time, and this is the way that it often happens in Latin music. So we'll have a group of 3 and then a group of 2, either like this or like this. Ding, dunk, ding, dunk, dunk, ding, dunk, ding, dunk, dunk. Or dump, dee, dump, dee, dump, dump, dee, dump, dump, dump. Sarah, would you play Claudius for me while I play a little music?
Yeah.
I told Sarah she didn't have to come, but since she did, I had to let her. I promise not to call you my little assistant.
It's not to give me a hard rhythm.
Okay?
Okay.
She's done this before. This is not the first time she's ever done this. Latin music you've heard, there's this sound in the background, okay? That kind of beat. And this is derived from the bell rhythm in a way that I hope is fairly clear to you, that you have groups of three and groups of two. When it gets turned into 4/4 time, it goes that way. All right, so what other musics does this affect? This part right here, and repeated it over and over. Early rock and roll, a lot of that stuff, okay? You'll find this in everywhere in Latin American music. Tango does it slow, samba does it fast. There are also musics that are done in three, where you get ding-dong, ding-dong, ding-dong-dong-dong, ding-dong. The hymn that we started out with last night. Okay. Excuse me. The left hand that I was playing was doing this the whole time. Don, ding, don, ding, don, ding, don. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, occasionally breaking into this, when the melody is come live in the light, 2 3 1 2 da ba da dee da da, 1 2 3 1 2 3 1. Okay, now listen to what that sounds like if I don't use that kind of left hand, but I revert to a much more European. It's not grounded. But when you've got that dong, ding, dong, ding, you got to work a little bit to make it happen. And when you have to work a little bit, then there's something that feels real about it. So for me, it's not just about, oh, these are cool rhythms. But it's like when I teach people, when I'm working oratorio, and we're singing something by Mendelssohn, let's say. If the choir doesn't sing with real clear legato, if they don't stay focused through the sound, if they don't, I'm not getting any phrases in my head right now, but if they don't sing with good classical style, it doesn't sound like they mean it. And it lets the air out. And so there's no uplifting, there's no spiritual thing that happens. Robert Shaw used to say, if the rhythm is right, his answer to was, well, when we get to the performance, the spirit will be there, and then everything will be a workout. You know, have you ever heard a conductor say that? his answer to that is, if the rhythm is right, the spirit will be there. And so that's part of what it's about. So one of the things that I would say as a little parenthesis to all of this is that these rhythms come from Africa. They do have associations with fertility religions, that sort of thing. I think we need to think about what that means as we think about anything that we appropriate for use in the church, whether it be dance, whether it be visual art, whether it be language kinds of things. We need to think about deeply about what it means, do it consciously. But I think if we are going to do music that has vernacular styles, that we cannot afford to whitewash it, we cannot afford to do it halfway, we can't afford to do it poorly, or we can't afford to do it in a way that tries to deny what it is. Okay.
Can I ask a question? The problem is, I agree with everything that you're saying, but the problem is that most little churches don't have the resources to do it well.
Yeah.
They have to do it, but they can't do it well. And for the last 11 years, I've worshipped in one of those congregations, and it's great to, I was so uplifted last night listening to you play and listening to how wonderfully it was done, seeing very little resources. But our church could never pull that off. So, what do you say about that, then don't bother, or
yeah, no, I'll move away a little bit from my agenda here, because I think that's a very important question. Several things. One is that the music does not have to be. It doesn't have to be difficult. I mean, I play a lot of notes, and so there is a certain energy that comes from the. I don't want to call it virtuosity, because it's not real virtuosity, but kind of imitation virtuosity. It sounds harder than it is, actually. What I was just doing at the piano right now, it comes from a fact that I have trained rhythmically through my work in jazz, so I can make it sound more complicated, because one hand is doing 1-2-1-2, and the other hand is doing 1-2-3-1-2-3. But granted, that's hard to do, and it's hard for a keyboard player to pull off. One of the things to think about is that African music and Latin American music depends upon a number of players. And one of the things that you can do in that kind of a situation is try to find, okay, who likes to play in a guitar in a garage band? Who's the bass player? Who's the guitar player? It's been great for me to work with the gospel choir at Valparaiso University, because I've had a window into the African American church. And one thing that I have seen that happens there is that they don't depend on somebody from the white horse from the outside. They raise up people from inside the church, and they put up with their problems. And this is a terrible generalization to make. Of course, there are some churches that do, some churches that don't, but it's something that I observed happen. And so find out what that person can do, what are the songs that they like. One of the things that has to happen is that people who are going to perform this kind of music must become conversant with the styles, and there are a lot of ways to do that. And one of the ways may mean listening to the radio. Not only the contemporary Christian station, but some other stations. But it's a big commitment. I guess that's probably that's the first thing to say. But I believe that it's really worth it.
I think also...
This is Rolf Vigdal. He's a village musician here, has been resident for a year. Wonderful composer. Going to sing one of his tunes tonight. Thanks, Rolf.
I think that once you have a good keyboard in your church, the next two instruments... Well, maybe an organ, but maybe even before the organ would be a djembe and claves, just because that it doesn't take. Now Sarah played very skillfully, but to play those rhythms doesn't take nearly as much training as it does to play with two hands to do those 3-2 or 3-4 things on the piano, and so a piano player playing it fairly straight can get that feeling if there's a clave player playing that rhythm, or just a simple hand drum. So that would be one way. I come from one of those churches, and I think that especially out west here, that's what most of the churches are, and so I think that's good that you're addressing it, because it is, that's what so many of us are from, those churches where we love it when we hear the resource, people, the human resources and the economic resources, so those would be some cheaper ways, but then the same thing, make sure that player, that whoever from the youth group that wants to play the drum isn't just going boom, 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 that they go boom, 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 that they're doing what it is that you're after.
It takes time to rehearse an ensemble, and that time has got to be built in, and the churches that do it well, the rhythm section meets every week. We have a special relationship with one of the largest African-American churches on the south side of Chicago, and it's been a blessing for me to get to know some of the people in their band. Yeah, it's just built in. They got a couple hours of rehearsal every week. Anytime they have a service, they have a rehearsal, and they really spend time with it. And here at Holden Village, I mean, we've spent serious time rehearsing for the services. Now, if I'm playing by myself like I did last night, I'm in a place now where I can play it through a couple of times, and I'm kind of there when I prepare for a Sunday morning service. It doesn't take me as long as it did when I was 18, of course. But this kind of music, it has payoffs because it requires a certain kind of commitment, and that's kind of what I was referring to when I was talking about, if you just play it in a kind of so-so style, then it's not only not very good, but it's also disappointing. It has a negative.
Not disappointing, hurtful. I'd say hurtful.
Hurtful. Well, I think that's fair to say.
There are Sundays. And I don't want to get you more sidetracked, but thanks for addressing both of you.
Are there any other thoughts about that from other people? Because that's maybe the key question, honestly. Mm-hmm. you know, how do we do this in places where we don't have a full-time music director and three really good professional musicians who do it for free?
Yeah. You know, actually, this is answered a question. We have started a quote contemporary service, and was the answer to the youth coming to the church. Well, what's happening? Everybody's cutting down to 8:30, and very few to the contemporary service. But just the point of rhythm—that's what I think. If we go here, the music is not that much different, you know. And it's like with guitars, they've got all the instruments, not drums though. But there's no rhythm, and I haven't really thought about that. There's nothing that really gives it. Gives it life. It's just singing more popular songs in the same old way. And so this, just that point alone helps me look at that a little differently.
I think the rhythm is the crucial thing. And the different rhythms for the different styles, I mean, that's, you know, people have devoted their entire life to playing one kind of salsa or one kind of gospel. And you know, I'm a generalist when it comes to all of that, so I have a few general things I can do, and I've got a bag of tricks that I can pull out that kind of apply to different things. And I think that church musicians today, you know, at Valparaiso University, we have, you know, a long tradition of excellence in church music, and it's hard for us to think about the curriculum in a way that really prepares students for doing not only the organ stuff, which is really hard. It's really hard to learn how to play the organ well. I can't do it. My feet go up and down for the pedals. That's it. You know, choosing notes with my feet, I'm sorry. One of the hardest things I had to do was that one of the requirements of this liturgy was that it have an organ version, and I had to go to the university and sit down and play through some accompaniments from the LBW with one voice to get a sense of, okay, now what is this going to require? And it's, yeah, it's very demanding, but doing the contemporary music well. Carrying on to what Rolf said, let me pass on to you one more thing. I had a student at the university who was an outstanding organist, had a master's degree from the University of Michigan, and then he, in composition, but a very fine organist as well, and he was studying organ at the university, and he studied composition with me for a while. And he was a church musician and knew he was going to have to do vernacular styles and had no background in it all. And really had no interest up to that point. Not like me. I listened to WLS when I was growing up and stuff like that. Played in jazz bands, and that's where I got the skills. And so I wrote him an email when I heard that I was going to make a presentation, got invited to make a presentation at liturgical institutes, which is most of this. And he said that a keyboard player who is really quite square, like himself, in the company of a good drummer and singers who knows the styles, can be the person around whom this coalesces, because they have to have the harmonic background. But what you play on the piano does not have to be particularly complicated. I did a series of accompaniments for This Far By Faith. Some of you would know that as an African-American resource that the ELCA published a couple of years ago. They had a liturgy for which the accompaniments were so primitive that they really didn't get you to gospel style. The person who wrote it played it much more interesting than what was on the page. And so I was commissioned to create accompaniments for it. And what was hard is that when I play these styles, I do play so many notes, and I was always trying to pare down. But what I've learned is that since those have been published, I didn't pare down enough. And so for the accompaniments that I created for this, I've made them much, much simpler.
Meaning they couldn't be played by a musician?
By a person who was not going to spend tons of time practicing.
Okay.
They were not they were not playable.
Not simple enough.
They were not quite simple enough. Let me make a couple of comments about harmony and give you just a little framework to think about harmony, and then we'll start looking at specific music, and then we can enter in this a little bit more. As far as styles go, I think of styles in vernacular music as having a range of different kinds of harmony. What we have in our hymn tradition, which again is pretty closely related to the Bach chorales, few of them as actually as complicated as Bach chorales, but still related to that. They're based on three-note groups called triads, the chord la-la-la-la-la that we use for warm-ups in choirs and that we use when we learn how to play the guitar. You learn how to play an E chord, and then you learn how to play an A chord, and a D chord, and a G chord. And essentially, we're grouping notes in threes, and it's a sound that you all know and we all love. And it's based on a physical property. Anyway, it's a triad. So simple tends to be pretty straightforward. They come in several different qualities, but major, which is what we played, is the main one, and then minor chords get used some in our hymns as well. Within a key, there are triads that have certain functions. The home chord. It's built on 1, 4, and 5. And the 5 chord tends to lead back to the 1 chord. That function is called dominant function. And leading us back home is, music theorists will tell us, really what this is all about. And if you analyze African rhythms, there is an element of taking us away and bringing us back home that's in that. If you analyze gamelan music from Indonesia, which is also based on rhythmic patterns, the big gong, you know you're home. And the piece is done when you've done so many cycles, you hit the big gong and everybody goes, oh yeah, and that's done. So there is always this kind of emotional element of some kind of point of arrival. Music exists, I think, to give us a sense of some kind of structure in our life. And so what happens is that in our system, it's become quite complicated so that the chords from one key can be borrowed when I'm playing in another key and used in different ways. And this is called secondary function. So when I'm playing in this key, C major, I can also borrow chords from another key. Secondary function. And what happens is that we have had a tradition where this has been allowed in addition to this. Then it's also possible to add another note to these triads. Well, we have a couple kinds that we do in our hymns, but not very many. But in jazz and in gospel music, we get a lot of those. Okay, so the secondary function is borrowing chords from another key. Then we get into things that are altered just because it sounds cool. Okay? All right? Well, that's not borrowed from any key that I know of. It just, hopefully, maybe it doesn't sound cool to you, but it did to me at the age that when I learned it. So there are lots of different kinds of harmonic worlds, but they occupy, in some sense, a kind of a continuum from simplest, where probably only one note would exist as another option out here to the end, and we're just not doing much chant music in our churches anymore, out to very complicated chords where you get one chord juxtaposed against another, that sort of thing. And as I think about music, and I'm going to talk about it in kind of three general categories, which is way too simple, but African-American gospel music, you get the full gamut of harmonies. And it just depends on which composer and on a composer, what day and what's the text and that sort of thing. But they just go the whole gamut of it. And when I do gospel accompaniments, I employ the full repertoire of jazz harmonies that I learned, all kinds of things. When I'm doing music which comes out of a much more folk-based and even country-based contemporary Christian tradition, and it's unfair to characterize all contemporary Christian music this way by any means, because there's all kinds of influences as there are in all popular musics today. But, for example, that one that we sang at the beginning last night, thank you. that I was just playing for you right now, I added a few what we call nines as kind of decorations, but I was playing almost entirely in this triadic language. And that's part of its very bright, almost glaringly bright, energetic character. If I would start adding other notes from the secondary function, if I would borrow chords from other keys, though I haven't practiced this, I'm going to have to go slower. How to do these things is what, how complicated is the language supposed to be. As I look at the Latin American materials that have been developed, the libro that was published by Augsburg, I find that the choices that were made by the editors, many of them Hispanic church people from across the country, they were also leading toward quite simple materials harmonically. Though certainly within Latin American music, there's a Latin jazz tradition that's got very complicated harmony. And the bossa nova, like I was playing before, uses very complicated jazz harmonies. But so when I was doing the Latin accompaniments for the mass, I was trying to stick much more in the triadic vein. I don't want to belabor this, but just to say that in addition to rhythmic variety, there's also variety in terms of both tune and harmonic backgrounds that we have. All right, let's go directly to the liturgy itself. I have a couple of other pieces I was going to show you, but I don't think I will. Actually, there is one more thing we need to talk about in relationship to harmony, and that is in the African-American tradition, there are also particularities of melody that I think are important for us to be aware of, because they affect the harmony, and they also affect how the music comes across. Let me point out to you how often that on the key word of this, wade in the water. Wade in the water. See how that lands on the and of two? This emphasis on the and of two is so central to this three against two feeling that we were talking about earlier. Okay? So rhythmically, this makes a huge difference. And in Latin American music, this and of two is so important that they have a name for it. It's called the bomba. And there is a style of music, actually a rhythm, that's focused on it that's called bomba. But this note, the and of two, do, dum, dee, dum, dum, dum. You remember that was the one that I was one of, dum, dee, dee, dum, dum, well, you can rock and you can rock, bom, dee, dum, 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 hitting that. When I was having Sarah playing, dum, dee, dum, dee, dum, dee, dum, dum, that's the one that's truly syncopated. All right? Now, in jazz music, go back to that first screen. You remember that when I had the twos, I had one tuck, tuck for the second part, for the two part, but I also had one tuck, tuck. It went both that way. In jazz music, a lot of times, emphasis on the offbeat. And in gospel, traditional gospel, nothing will come to mind. Anyway, clapping on the offbeats. This is one way we can tell, you know, what where your congregation comes from. They clap on the offbeats or they clap on the onbeats, you know. That's a big one. Well, it comes from that rhythmic tradition.
Melodically, however, the music that is based on the turn of the century, what we sort of became aware of in popular music at the turn of the century, based on what we call the blues scale, does not have the same kinds of tendencies. When I was talking about secondary function and dominant function of leading to home, there's a whole world of music that does not have that influence. There is that music in Western tradition as well, in folk music, that often that leading home note is not there. But in Wade in the Water, Wade in the Water, children, Wade, da-da-da-da-da-da. Notice that E is the home note. The note that comes after E is not D sharp. Water, children. You know, can you imagine? You know, water, children. Wade in the water. God's in lot of trouble. And then you finally get the water. I would love to have been there when this song was first sung. Because my guess is, and I could be wrong, but my guess is that that was also a D natural. But that it has been, through the years, being harmonized, turned into a D sharp so that it fits the kind of harmonies you can play with it. All right. So you can hear, I'm singing this phrase for you. Water, children, wait. Now, what about it? How's my intonation?
Bending
it. Oh, yeah. Which note's the worst out of tune? Listen to it again. Water, children.
The
B. The B. Yeah, and now listen to, and also listen to the syllable dren of children. Water, children, wait. What I do with it?
I raised it.
It wasn't quite a G natural. It was actually headed up toward G sharp. Okay? Now, if we count steps of the scale, where E is 1, this is 3, and this is 5. This is 7. Those are the characteristic notes of what we call the blues scale. So if I'm playing in the blues, even in a major key, this is it. This is a really for real in minor piece. But I could do play a very basic blues. If I'm playing an E chord, E major, E, G sharp, B, D natural, and E. Well, if this were going to be common practice harmony, it would be. But it's not. So, by using that lowered seventh, I have changed the functionality of it. I've added a level of dissonance into the very essence of how the piece sounds. When I get home to the end of the piece, I'm not just going to play a major chord. No. Can you imagine?
But it's, Dennis, it's not really dissonant because that seventh is really like consistent with physics, isn't it? I mean, that minor seventh, isn't that what you get in the harmonic series?
That's an interesting, that's an interesting one, Rolf. As you go through, I made the reference earlier to how the major triad comes out of that. Yes, if you go up to the next step of the harmonic series, yes, that seventh is there, and you'll find that seventh in the music of Debussy.
Right.
Yeah.
And I also think that playing with that third, that minor third to the major third, the reason it works is because that's you're crossing the perfect third in the process, which we don't really use, but I think
right.
I suspect that's part of the appeal.
Okay. Rolf has taken you another step. I don't know how many of you are aware, but in the overtone series, what happens is that in order to come out with an even tempered scale, we had to do a certain amount of violence to the notes as they appear in nature in relationship to one another. The fifths have had to be shortened a little bit. The thirds have had to be expanded a little bit in both directions in order to fit even temperament. And as a guitarist, when he's tuning, he's often tuning by the use of overtones, but he's got to be careful.
And cellists have to be careful, because if they tune from A all the way down to C, their low C is going to be flat to the piano C. The viola is going to be flat to the piano C. So you're always making these kinds of adjustments. It's very symbolic of life. And so what he's saying is that the reason that works, the thing that happens, Wolf, is that it, when you start to try to carry this theory into all world musics, that it becomes very complicated to try to say, okay, now the divisions of the Indian scale are all based on you know, those kinds of things. It may be that there are physical resonance factors in play. I'm not the person to ask about it. But I've heard that and I've actually preached a little bit of it myself. But I think the point of it is, however, is that our pretty triads, the triad is a very clear, very, to us, most of us, bright, optimistic sound, happy triads, and minor music makes us feel downbeat. And one of the things that's a criticism of a lot of contemporary music, and it's not just in contemporary Christian, also I think could be in other kinds of church music as well, is that we don't tend to do minor music very much. And when it comes time that we need to have a way to relate to tragedy, we have to have a way to relate to grief, to ambiguity, we don't have a tonal language that really represents that. What I wanted to say with this in relationship to the blues scale is that as we begin to get into more complicated harmonies, a lot of it is based on inclusion of this lowered seventh, inclusion of this lowered third against a major third sometimes on the keyboard. I can't bend pitches, so what do? I play the major third and the minor third against each other at the same time. Here's the major triad, E, G sharp, B. Here's adding the seventh, D natural. And now I'm playing the major third, G sharp, against a minor third, G natural. Okay? Those of you who are old enough to remember Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Spinning, the opening of Spinning Wheel. Yeah, it's that major third versus the minor third. Well, that kind of thing happens in the music of Bartok. Happened in the music of Stravinsky a lot. It was happening in Western art music at the turn of the century, at the same time that it was becoming used by popular composers. Being taken out of the black blues and spiritual realm and started being used in popular music, and now here at the end of the century, it's getting into church music as well. Okay, don't want to belabor that point too much. One of the other elements of the blues, before I move too far away from that, that is also, I think, interesting in relationship to rhythmic things, is something that's called stop time. And again, it's how dramatic are we going to allow our church music to be? And how much do we really want it to affect us? Do we really want to allow ourselves to be vulnerable to what's happening on Sunday morning or not? This is a section from the Liturgy of Joy that I did the accompaniments for. And what I'd like to point out to you, first of all, it's in key of E flat major, and take a look and see how many accidentals there are. And this is borrowed secondary function for the most part. But as you look at the top of the second page here, restore to me the joy of your salvation. One of the things that I just loved about this piece was its wonderful rhythmic energy that is implied in these four straight quarter notes. We've talked about, you know, the bomba and all that kind of stuff, but restore to me the joy. Get it? Right? There's an insistence there, that same. No, boom, boom, you know? It's like the bass drum on a rock and roll first drum set, you know? And what I wanted to do was to give it a kick. And I did that by making the accompaniment be very short. And you notice I did that a little bit of that last night on that opening hymn as well. There were some places where I was playing short chords, was kind of trying to goad the congregation a little bit. And this is the way it sounds. Restore to me the joy of salvation. Part of the thrill and part of the joy of this music as well. Okay, I think all I'm going to have time to do is to show you a little bit in terms of different versions of accompaniments. Let's look at the Gloria first. Now, what you have in front of you is the the congenial version. This is a little bit innocuous. It's a style which I don't think requires too much in the way of I don't have the accompaniment for this one that I can put up, I'm sorry to say. But it's not a hard accompaniment. It still uses a little bit of that 2 against 3, but it's written out. And it lies under the hand very well. If you look at the piece, you notice that it goes from F major on Glory to God to F minor at Lord God. It actually doesn't have the D flat there because there are not very many D flats in the section. It's modal, and we won't talk about that today in terms of the distinctions. But it has a sound that's very similar to my ear, not rhythmically, but melodically. Sounds kind of liturgical. It's not that different from what you might know in the LBW. All right, let's sing through some of this, and I will play it with the as close as I can remember to the simple accompaniment version that I've set aside for the kind of contemporary Christians kind of sound. Thank you.
rest of the lines. All right. So what I'd like to do is show you, as I have changed styles, I did have that coming, but it's a good thing I didn't try to play it, though, because I don't have it memorized. But here's the last page of this in the sort of contemporary version. And if you take a look at this, pianistically, I don't know how many of you play keyboards, but this is something that somebody could expect to learn in not too much time. This is very doable. It's not as hard as some of the with one voice accompaniments. And the characteristics of it, as you can see, if you can analyze this kind of thing visually, is that you get the full triads quite easily. It's lying under the hand. And this is the kind of thing that keyboard players have to look for, and one of the choices that I was making in terms of how to accompany, this could be quite satisfying. One of the things that I did do, which you've heard me do here a few times, is down here for the very last chorus, the keyboard player, if they're able to, could switch around and actually do a simple dee-da-dee-da kind of bell accompaniment in the right hand and play the melody in the left hand. Something which organists do all the time, but pianists don't do very much. And it takes some practice to learn how to do it, but if it's written out for you like that, hopefully it's not too hard. So that's sort of the contemporary version of this. Now let's take a look at the Latin version. And I'm just giving you the last page here. As you can see, it looks quite similar, except the left hand is going dong, ding, dong, ding, ding, bong, ding, bong, bong, bong. Well, what's that? That's the clave. Tuck, tuck, tick, tick, tick. Okay, quite common, particularly in more simple Latin styles for the bass to carry that rhythm or something very similar to it. Okay? And then again, if the keyboard player is capable, when we get to the end, there's a little salsa thing that we did do on Sunday night. The bass line now becomes a little more complicated, doing something called, as I read the literature, I'm coming out of books now, which is always very dangerous, but I believe it's called a tumbao pattern when you begin to have the syncopations like you see right here. And the congregation has already sung this through several times with the accompaniments of ding, ding, dong, ding, gong, ding, dong, ding, dong. And hitting that note that comes before the end of the bar, which also has a name, then that gives a kind of drive going ahead. And then the right hand is playing a pattern, which you'll recognize by sound from hearing salsa dance somewhere in your travels or elevators or So this is an attempt on my part to try to give a little bit of a more energetic flavor. And my favorite thing every time when I was working on these was to get to the end and hear in my mind the preacher saying, "Let us pray." It's just, One of the things that was very interesting to me as I was looking at this, as I was taking on this project, is first of all, most of this stuff is not poetry. So it doesn't fall into nice even patterns. And the thing about vernacular music is that it tends to be built on dance forms, as back in the 1200s it was built on dance rhythms. And that tends to go in four-bar phrases. And a lot of the liturgy does not lend itself easily to four-bar-ness. As a matter of fact, a lot of the beauty of traditional plain chant is that the slight emphases that there are in the melody often come at different places than the emphases of the syllables. Well, when it's subtle and when it's gentle, it's a wonderful interplay that can kind of help keep you awake and provide a nice contrast with it. But trying to create things in four bar stuff is tough. Also, trying to come up with a melody in one rhythmic style that I thought could be true to these, one rhythm that would be true to all these different kinds of rhythmic styles is difficult. So I actually did a contrasting setting, which I understand a number of the composers did, for
the gospel version. And as you can see, suddenly we're not in 3-4 anymore. And take a look at how many accidentals there are. And cautionary accidentals. I did not make a copy of this for myself. I hope I do.
I kind of hope I remember how it goes. I think I do. So what I'm going to play for you is something that is a lot like what's up there, whether it's exactly the same. Exciting things for me in gospel music is when the rhythm section drops out and the choir gets going and the congregation starts clapping, and it's just a wonderful moment. And then they also have things, little breaks that get put on the ends of songs, often called special. And so that's what this little thing is down here. And you notice it was titled Mass for Peacemakers. One of the things that really struck me, has always struck me about the Liturgy of the Mass, is how many times the word peace is mentioned. It's really amazing. It's fixated on peace. And so to have a little refrain about peace that starts soft and builds up gives another way to lift up by getting down, as I said. All right. Well, so hopefully this has given you a little insight into some of the thinking that goes on. And I don't want to minimize the complexity of what it takes to be able to do vernacular musics well. Ron just came in. He's a music director at church where this kind of thing is very, very much the language of the congregation. And everybody expects to be in that style and would be, as I would expect, uncomfortable in a service where none of it was present.
Where none of it was present. They can deal with a little... They can deal with multiculturalism.
Good. You know what? What I'd like to say is, I know it's time for lunch, and I think we should stop the tape now. Thanks for your attention. The tape, the CD. Thanks for your attention. I'm happy to answer more questions and to talk about this more. It's very interesting to me, but I don't want anybody to feel like you need to stay. And if you have questions about specific rhythms and stuff, talk to Ron because he's a great drummer. He knows that stuff. So if you have any other questions or comments that you'd like to discuss, and like I said, please feel free to leave if you like.